content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the November 4th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Clinton Trump in the final stretch. What happened? As polls showed Hillary Clinton with a substantial lead over Donald Trump, the two presidential candidates vigorously campaigned in battleground states that will decide the November 8 election. At a rally in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, Trump sought to refocus the campaign on policy with a list of actions he'd take in his first 100 days in office, including passing a broad tax cut, halting illegal immigration, renegotiating trade agreements, and repealing Obamacare. But the Republican nominee went off script to insist again that the election was being rigged against him and pledged to sue the 11 liars who recently came forward to accuse him of sexual assault. He made the same assertions at stops in Florida, North Carolina, and Ohio. Clinton, whose campaign was hit by another batch of WikiLeaks email releases, made stops in many of the same states, with help from surrogates including President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden. The final push in campaigning came after last week's third and final debate, when Trump doubled down on his controversial refusal to confirm he would accept the results of the election, and clashed with Clinton on issues such as late-term abortion and gun rights. Polls varied widely, ranging from a 12-point Clinton lead in an ABC News poll to a 2-point Trump lead in an Investor's Business Daily poll. The Real Clear Politics national poll average put Clinton's lead at 5.9 points, down from 6.6 points last week. The Democratic nominee also retained her average leads in most of the key battleground states, including Florida, 1.6 points, Pennsylvania, 4.4, and North Carolina, 2. Trump insisted that most polls were inaccurate, telling rally goers, "I believe we're actually winning." What the editorial said. "Don't write Trump off just yet," said the Washington Times. "He may be trailing in most of the polls, but not all." The Investor's Business Daily poll, which nailed the 2012 final margin, has the race as effectively dead even. That poll might be an outlier, of course, and Trump will need a big comeback to win. But 2016 has been full of surprises. If it can be done, this might be the year. "For the sake of the country, we need a landslide victory for Clinton," said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger. "Trump has led a campaign of bigotry and ignorance, targeting women, Muslims, and other groups with a disgusting and divisive attacks. A clear and decisive victory for Clinton would show that America is made of better stuff." What the columnist said. "How different this election would have been with a strong Republican candidate," said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. "The Democrats should be getting savaged for the failures of the Affordable Care Act, for Obama's disastrous foreign policy weakness in Syria and with Russia, and for overseeing the most sluggish economic recovery since World War II. But all these issues have been eclipsed by Trump's early morning Twitter war with a former Miss Universe, his videotaped boast about grabbing women, and his aside that Clinton is a nasty woman. All Clinton has to do is sit back and let Trump self-destruct." "She deserves way more credit than that," said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. "A few weeks ago, Trump and Clinton were almost tied in the polls. What changed? The Democratic nominee crushed her opponent in the most effective series of debate performances in modern political history. She skillfully got under Trump's skin, questioning the size of his fortune, bringing up his attacks on women, telling him he choked when he met the president of Mexico. Trump, who dominated his male Republican rivals during the primary debates, was reduced to angry, childish sputtering. By now whining that the election is rigged against him, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post, Trump may depress the Republican turnout, turning his excuse into a self-fulfilling prophecy. There are four possible scenarios on the table for November 8th, said Nate Silver in 538.com. Clinton could win by a landslide, or she could win by a margin similar to Obama's in 2012, about 4 points. Or either Clinton or Trump could snatch a victory in a razor-thin race like the 2000 election. The Democratic nominee is currently in the Obama zone, but in the final days, the polls could tighten. This election isn't over yet. And a second main story, Clinton's Morocco mess. What happened? Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton faced renewed accusations this week that she had set up a pay-to-play system for foreign governments after leaked emails revealed she agreed to attend a Clinton Global Initiative event last year in Morocco in exchange for a $12 million pledge from the country's King Mohammed VI. In the emails, Clinton's aides expressed concern that her attendance at the May 2015 event, scheduled a month after she was set to launch a presidential run, would raise criticisms that she sold access to a foreign leader in exchange for a Clinton Foundation donation. This was HRC's idea, wrote Huma Abedin, using Clinton's nickname. She created this mess, and she knows it. In the end, Clinton pulled out of the meeting, and Bill and Chelsea Clinton attended in her place. Clinton Foundation records don't show whether the charity ultimately received the $12 million. The hacked messages were part of more than 50,000 emails stolen from the account of Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta by Russian-connected hackers and released by WikiLeaks. In some emails, Podesta complains about Clinton's political missteps, including her decision to use a private email server while Secretary of State. We've taken on a lot of water, said Podesta. Most of that has to do with terrible decisions made pre-campaign, but a lot has to do with her instincts. What the columnist said. Hillary Clinton has gotten very lucky in the 2016 presidential election, said David Graham in the Atlantic.com, and on few items as clearly as the Clinton Foundation. While Clinton critics obsess over her private email server, the real scandal has always been the family charity. Hillary and Bill have collected millions of dollars in personal speaking fees and Clinton Foundation donations from foreign governments and corporations seeking U.S. government access. There's a clear pattern here, said Sagar Njeti in DailyCaller.com. The foundation accepted millions from human rights abusers like Saudi Arabia and companies with economic interests in decisions by Clinton's Department of State. Clinton is hardly a corrupt puppet of the Moroccan government, said Jeff Stein in Vox.com. She wasn't Secretary of State or a presidential candidate when she made the deal and was in no position to give King Mohammed any preferential treatment. All we know is that Clinton said she would go to an event with another head of state to raise money that was all for a charitable cause and then pulled out when she realized it looked bad. True, nothing in the exchange appears to be illegal, said Russell Berman in the Atlantic.com. But everyone knows these foreign heads didn't dole out donations purely out of the goodness of their hearts. They wanted to get in a room with a possible future U.S. president. The Moroccan episode is such a quintessentially Clinton controversy. As Podesta hints, Bill and Hillary should know better. And yet, convinced of their own righteousness, they do it anyway. Given the longevity of such behavior, there's little hope that the next 4 years of a possible Clinton White House would be any different. Our controversy of the week, the 2016 race. Can presidential elections be rigged? The hypocrisy is difficult to bear, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. When, at last week's presidential debate, Donald Trump said, "I'll keep you in suspense as to whether he'll accept the results of the vote on November 8th, it sent liberal pundits into paroxysms of exaggerated horror. By questioning whether the 2016 election is being rigged, the Republican nominee was attacking the very fabric of our democracy and fanning the flames of civil unrest. This is a curious charge coming from the left, given that liberals have spent the entirety of the 21st century questioning the legitimacy of the 2000 election and insisting that a corrupt Supreme Court intervened to rob Al Gore of the presidency by halting a chaotic recount and declaring George W. Bush the winner. Not only have Democrats never accepted the result of the 2000 election," said Andrew McCarthy, also in NationalReview.com, "they've spent the years since fighting tooth and nail against every common sense measure to protect election integrity. Given the history of shenanigans in our electoral system, why should any candidate, least of all Trump, presume the legitimacy of an election that hasn't happened yet?" Comparing Al Gore to Donald Trump is like comparing a fire marshal investigating the cause of a blaze to an arsonist, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. The 2000 election was the closest in U.S. history, decided in the end by the votes of only 537 Floridians, after thousands of ambiguous ballots were discounted. Gore had every right to ask for a recount, and even though he won the national vote by 500,000, he deferred to the court's blatantly partisan 5-4 ruling and conceded with exceptional graciousness. Gore had some very legitimate grievances, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Thousands of Democrats failed to have their votes counted due to faulty ballot design. Before the election, Governor Jeb Bush purged Florida voter rolls of felons and, in a convenient mistake, disenfranchised thousands of non-felons, most of them black. Trump, conversely, is questioning the election in advance on the basis of evidence-free conspiracy theories about voter fraud, a crime that multiple studies have found to be so rare as to be irrelevant. "There is indeed a conspiracy to rig the election," said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. "But Trump is the beneficiary, not the victim. When Barack Obama was elected in 2008, panicky Republicans launched an aggressive campaign for new voter restrictions on the state level, using false stories and insinuations of voter fraud to make it harder for minorities to cast ballots. That effort continues in the form of voter ID laws in multiple Republican-run states that courts have found are specifically designed to exclude IDs used by blacks, Hispanics, and students. Voter suppression, not voter fraud, is the real threat to our democracy." Both sides are hurling apocalyptic charges, said Herman Lopez in Vox.com. "But after the election, American democracy will be fine. If Trump loses, he may refuse to concede and claim fraud, but other Republicans will denounce his comments and declare Clinton the victor. And the country will move on." "That depends," said Darren Samuelson in Politico.com. "If Hillary Clinton wins by a comfortable margin, then yes, Trump's claim of widespread fraud will be just a footnote in the history of a wild campaign. But if the election is a squeaker, like the 2000 race, the work Trump has done priming his supporters to believe the election is being stolen could matter a great deal. God only knows what happens then." And it was a good week for clarity after the Trump campaign ended a Twitter debate about the candidate's word choices by confirming that he frequently uses the term big league and not bigly as a synonym for major or a lot. It was a good week for Christopher Marlowe after the Oxford University Press announced that the Elizabethan playwright will be given the official co-authorship credit on William Shakespeare's three historical dramas about Henry VI. And it was a good week for boxing promoters after Vice President Joe Biden, 73, said he'd like to take Donald Trump behind the gym to punish him for boasting about abusing women. "I'd love that," Trump said, 70, shot back, sarcastically calling Biden Mr. Tough Guy. But it was a bad week for Answering Nature's Call after some 100,000 beer-guzzling fans at the Alabama-Texas A&M football game were told not to use the bathrooms during halftime due to a water pressure problem. "There are people in the bathroom," a reporter noted, "but I do not know if they're flushing." It was a bad week for fashion criticism after 400 Rhode Island women staged a yoga pants parade in response to a man's letter to the local paper complaining that women over the age of 20 looked bizarre and disturbing in the form-fitting garment. And it was a bad week for risk assessment after a new Vox Morning Consult poll found that 42% of Americans said they were afraid of clowns, more than the 32% who fear climate change. Moving on to the briefing page, this week titled The Hacking Epidemic. Cyber attackers are waging war on banks, utilities, and companies, and might try to disrupt the U.S. election. How frequent are hacks? In the U.S. alone, government and private targets are pummeled by hundreds of thousands of hacking attempts every hour. Cyber attackers have breached the Pentagon, State Department, and the White House, stolen the personal data of an estimated one-half of Americans in attacks on banks and tech companies like Yahoo, and provided WikiLeaks with the personal emails of Democratic Party officials, as well as generals and former secretaries of state. These cyber criminals can potentially target every aspect of our lives that involves an internet connection. They could suddenly apply the brakes on smart cars or take over a passenger jet's avionics system. If they finally breached critical infrastructure services like the electrical grid, as they attempted to do at least 79 times in 2014, the results would be nightmarish, said Tony Lawrence, chief executive officer of cybersecurity firm Vor Technology. Imagine if someone shut down the power to New York's traffic grid during rush hour. Where do these attacks originate? Some are carried out by international hacktivist groups like Anonymous, whose members style themselves digital Robin Hoods pursuing justice against the world's powerful. Two hacker groups of this type claimed credit for a major wave of denial-of-service cyber attacks last week that blocked access to such sites as Twitter, Netflix, and Amazon. But most hacks are directed or sponsored by nation states. The two worst culprits are China and Russia. China's mysterious Unit 61398, part of the People's Liberation Army, has reportedly been responsible for at least 141 successful cyber intrusions on 20 major U.S. industrial sectors, including oil and gas pipelines. In Russia, hacking groups called Cozy Bear and Guccifer 2.0 have targeted foreign critics of President Vladimir Putin and in December shut down part of the electric grid in Ukraine. How do the hacks work? About 91% begin with a simple phishing attack in which an email masquerading as a legitimate communication from a well-known company invites the recipient to click on a link or open an attachment. That attachment or link is actually loaded with malware. If just one of the hundreds of people in a company or government agency targeted by this attack falls for the trick, His or her computer downloads the malware, giving the hacker a backdoor into the organization's entire network. Many hacks involve spear phishing, a more personalized email designed to look like a message from a friend or colleague. Another phishing technique is to encourage recipients to enter their account details into an official-looking form from a web company or a government agency. How much damage can hacks do? They can wreak absolute havoc, economically, politically, and physically. The North Korea-directed attack on Sony Pictures Entertainment unleashed a stream of embarrassing company memos, destroyed its computers, and caused Sony an estimated $100 million in damages. A cyber-physical attack on the electric grid wouldn't just cut off electricity for tens of millions of Americans. It could also shut down the water supply, cell phone towers, trains, airport landing lights. The list is endless. That's the kind of damage terrorist groups like ISIS dream of inflicting. These savages have so far only figured out how to use the internet to proselytize, said FBI Director James Comey. What happens if they figure out how to use it to break into a chemical plant or a blood bank? How can the U.S. respond? The government has hired hundreds of cyber detectives to monitor federal agencies for breaches, and more than 6,000 hackers have been recruited to U.S. Cyber Command, a military unit responsible for both combating and waging hack attacks. One such alleged U.S. offensive, the Stuxnet computer worm, silently destroyed 984 of Iran's nuclear centrifuges in 2010. Russia could be the next target. Vice President Joe Biden recently warned that the Obama administration is preparing to send a message to Putin for his country's alleged role in the hacks on the Democratic National Committee. Some speculate the U.S. could, for example, hack into proof that Putin and his oligarch cronies have stashed billions in foreign bank accounts. One major risk of tit-for-tat hacking, however, is that it can escalate into all-out cyber war. What would cyber war look like? It would be silent but enormously destructive. The two sides could block access to the global positioning system, disrupt air traffic control and electric grids, and block access to the internet or fill popular sites with propaganda, causing widespread chaos and fear. Cyber war is the only field of warfare in which the U.S. doesn't have a clear advantage over its foes, warned then Joint Chiefs Chairman Martin Dempsey before he retired last year. It's a level playing field, said Dempsey, and that makes this chairman very uncomfortable. Moving into the best columns now, we'll take two from the U.S. The first, the dangers posed by Clinton. Hillary Clinton presents herself as the safer choice in this election, said Ross Douthat. Her main argument, choose steady competence over boastful recklessness, is working because Trump sounds so unhinged and erratic. But a Clinton presidency, too, poses a real threat, the dangers of elite groupthink. Almost every crisis that has befallen the West since 2000 began with the blindness of government experts to their own fallibility. The Iraq War was pushed hard by the Bush administration, but was embraced by center-left pillars such as Tony Blair, Hillary, and more than half of Senate Democrats. Well-meaning interventions also gave us our splendid little war in Libya and the resulting chaos. Both parties' elites helped produce the 2008 financial crisis by combining financial deregulation with a housing policy that encouraged every American to finance a home. Across the Atlantic, experts gave Europe the now unraveling folly of a common currency for 19 separate nations and economies, and a reckless open borders policy that's led to polarization and violence. By temperament, the pragmatic Clinton is averse to anything obviously radical or dangerous. but she shows every sign of being just as ready to march into folly as her peers. Ivanka's tarnished brand. Ivanka Trump is now watching her most valuable asset being destroyed, said Joy Ann Reed. The former model, 34, has spent years leveraging her surname into a fashion business aimed at aspirational young working women, as well as helping her dad and her brothers market the Trump name through swanky golf courses, hotels, and condos. But his presidential campaign has become a runaway dumpster fire that's burning the Trump brand to cinders. Ivanka's adoring dad has been transformed from a reality show bon vivant to a racist, woman-groping business failure and tax cheat. His approval rating among women has fallen off a cliff, and there's a growing boycott of Ivanka's line of foreign-made clothes, shoes, and handbags, and the retailers who carry them. Despite her polished charm, Ivanka will also find it much harder to persuade developers to pay a premium fee to slap the Trump name on the side of their buildings. The Trump brand no longer stands for opulence and wealth, but for bigotry, sexism, and rage. Ivanka deserves no pity. She elected to tout her father's candidacy at the Republican convention and to campaign for him with women and young voters. But what daddy gave her, he's now taking away. And this from the United Kingdom. Posthumously pardoning gay men. Britain's government is about to correct an egregious historical wrong, said Sephora Smith in the London Evening Standard. Under the so-called Turing Law, now working its way through Parliament, some 35,000 gay and bisexual British men who were convicted of sexual offenses that have since been decriminalized would receive posthumous pardons. The bill is named after Alan Turing, the mathematician and computer pioneer who cracked Nazi codes in World War II, but was later convicted of gross indecency for having consensual gay sex. He underwent chemical castration in 1952 to avoid prison and committed suicide 2 years later at age 41. Turing was pardoned in 2013, and after a Hollywood biopic of the codebreaker came out in 2014, pressure mounted for more gay men to receive similar pardons. The Turing Law would presumably apply to playwright Oscar Wilde, who was imprisoned for gross indecency in 1895, and to many others prosecuted before homosexual acts were decriminalized in 1967. It's hugely important, said Justice Minister Sam Gyimah, that we pardon people convicted of historical sexual offenses who would be innocent of any crime today. But this bill only does that for the dead, said legal activist Katie Watts in independent.co.uk. Gyimah personally filibustered a different bill that would have extended the pardon to 15,000 living men, saying some pedophiles and rapists might get a pardon by accident. Those convicted of homosexual acts who are still alive, he said, must apply to the Home Office for a disregard, and then they too can be pardoned. But since the disregard process began in 2012, there have been 320 applications, of which 83, a worryingly low number, have been successful. The crime of soliciting, for example, is not covered. That means a man who received a caution for soliciting in 1995, like one client of mine, is not eligible for pardon and can't work as a teacher because his record shows a sex offense. The Turing bill also fails to address the state's historic mistreatment of lesbians, said Katie Welsh in the Daily Telegraph. That's because lesbian sex wasn't explicitly criminalized. So we ended up institutionalized in asylums rather than prisons. Are we supposed to just shrug it off now, happy that our gay brethren's records have been expunged? Perhaps we should be calling for a little less pride and a lot more shame. It's a mistake to judge our forebears by modern norms, said Jeffrey Alderman in The Spectator. Look at the past and you'll find countless acts that were deemed criminal offenses but aren't anymore. Why not issue pardons to suffragettes, including my great aunt, who were fined or imprisoned? What about the unfortunates who were transported to Australia for petty crimes, or the shell-shocked soldiers executed for cowardice during World War I? We cannot rewrite the past, and it smacks of Stalinism if we invoke the law in an attempt to do so. We're on to the last word, our in-depth article, this week titled, How the Web Almost Killed Me. A never-ending barrage of Facebook updates, breaking news tweets, and time-sucking apps is taking over our lives, says writer Andrew Sullivan. What price are we paying for constant distraction? I was sitting in a large meditation hall in a converted novitiate in central Massachusetts when I reached into my pocket for my iPhone. A woman in the front of the room gamely held a basket in front of her, beaming beneficently like a priest with a collection plate. I duly surrendered my little device, only to feel a sudden pang of panic on my way back to my seat. If it hadn't been for everyone staring at me, I might have turned around immediately and asked for it back. But I didn't. I knew why I'd come here. A year before, like many addicts, I had sensed a personal crash coming. For a decade and a half, I'd been a web obsessive, publishing blog posts multiple times a day, 7 days a week, and ultimately corralling a team that curated the web every 20 minutes during peak hours. Each morning began with a full immersion in the stream of internet consciousness and news, jumping from site to site, tweet to tweet, breaking news story to hottest take, scanning countless images and videos, catching up with multiple memes. Throughout the day, I'd cough up an insight or an argument or a joke about what had just occurred or what was happening right now. My brain had never been so occupied so insistently by so many different subjects and in so public a way for so long. I was, in other words, a very early adopter of what we might now call living in the web. As the years went by, I realized I was no longer alone. Facebook soon gave everyone the equivalent of their own blog and their own audience. More and more people got a smartphone, connecting them from instantly to a deluge of febrile content, forcing them to cull and absorb and assimilate the online torrent as relentlessly as I had once. Twitter emerged as a form of instant blogging of microthoughts. Users were as addicted to the feedback as I had long been, and even more prolific. Then the apps descended, like the rain, to inundate what was left of our free time. It was ubiquitous now, this virtual living, this never-stopping, this always updating. If the internet killed you, I used to joke, then I would be the first to find out. Years later, the joke was running thin. In the last year of my blogging life, my health began to give out. 4 bronchial infections in 12 months had been progressively harder to kick. Vacations, such as they were, had become more mere opportunities for sleep. My friendships had atrophied as my time away from the web dwindled. My doctor, dispensing one more course of antibiotics, finally laid it on the line. Did you really survive HIV or die of the web? But the rewards were many, an audience of up to 100,000 people a day, a new media business that was actually profitable, a constant stream of things to annoy, enlighten, or infuriate me, a niche in the nerve center of the exploding global conversation, and a way to measure success in big and beautiful data that was a constant dopamine bath for the writerly ego. If you had to reinvent yourself as a writer in the internet age, I reassured myself, then I was ahead of the curve. The problem was that I hadn't been able to reinvent myself as a human being. I tried reading books, but that skill now began to elude me. After a couple of pages, my fingers twitched for a keyboard. I tried meditation, but my mind bucked and bridled as I tried to still it. I got a steady workout routine, and it gave me the only relief I could measure for an hour or so a day. But over time, in this pervasive virtual world, the online clamor grew louder and louder. Although I spent hours each day, alone and silent, attached to a laptop, it felt as if I were in a constant cacophonous crowd of words and images, sounds and ideas, emotions and tirades, a wind tunnel of deafening, deadening noise. So much of it was irresistible, as I fully understood. So much of the technology was irreversible, as I also knew. But I'd begun to fear that this new way of living was actually becoming a way of not living. By the last few months, I realized I had been engaging, like most addicts, in a form of denial. I'd long treated my online life as a supplement to my real life. But then I began to realize, as my health and happiness deteriorated, that this was not a both-and kind of situation. It was either-or. Every hour I spent online was not spent in the physical world. Multitasking was a mirage. This was a zero-sum game, zero-sum question. And so I decided, after 15 years, to live in reality. Since the invention of the printing press, every new revolution in information technology has prompted apocalyptic fears. From the panic that easy access to the vernacular English Bible would destroy Christian orthodoxy, all the way to the revulsion in the 1950s at the barbaric young medium of television, cultural critics have moaned and wailed at every turn. Each shift represented a furthering fracturing of attention. And yet society has always managed to adapt and adjust, without obvious damage, and with some more than obvious progress. So it's perhaps too easy to view this new era of mass distraction as something uniquely dystopian. But it sure does represent a huge leap from even the very recent past. The data bewilder. Every single minute on the planet, YouTube users upload 400 hours of video and Tinder users swipe profiles more than a million times. Each day there are literally billions of Facebook likes. Online outlets now publish exponentially more material than they once did, churning out articles at a rapid-fire pace, adding new details to the news every few minutes. Blogs, Facebook feeds, Tumblr accounts, tweets, and propaganda outlets repurpose, borrow, and add top spin to the same output. We absorb this content no longer primarily by buying a magazine or paper, by bookmarking our favorite website, or by actively choosing to read or watch. We are instead guided to those info nuggets by myriad little interruptions on social media, all cascading at us with individually tailored relevance and accuracy. Do not flatter yourself into thinking that you have much control over which temptations you click on. Silicon Valley's technologists and their ever-perfecting algorithms have discovered the form of bait that will have you jumping like a witless minnow. No information technology ever had this depth of knowledge of its consumers, or greater capacity to tweak their synapses to keep them engaged. And the engagement never ends. Not long ago, surfing the web, however addictive, was a stationary activity. At your desk, at work, or at home on your laptop, you disappeared down a rabbit hole of links and resurfaced minutes or hours later to re-encounter the world. But the smartphone then went and made the rabbit hole portable, inviting us to get lost in it anywhere, at any time, whatever else we might be doing. Information soon penetrated every waking moment of our lives, and it did so with a staggering swiftness. We almost forget that 10 years ago there were no smartphones, and as recently as 2011, only a third of Americans owned one. Now nearly two-thirds do. That figure reaches 85% when you're only counting young adults. And 46% of Americans told Pew surveyors last year a simple but remarkable thing. They could not live without one. The device went from unknown to indispensable in less than a decade. A small but detailed 2015 study of young adults found that participants were using their phones 5 hours a day at 85 separate times. Most of these interactions were for less than 30 seconds, but they add up. Just as revealing, the users weren't fully aware of how addicted they were. They thought they picked up their phones half as much as they actually did. Whether they were aware of it or not, a new technology had seized control of around one-third of these young adults' waking hours. The interruptions often feel pleasant, of course, because they are usually the work of your friends. Distractions arrive in your brain connected to people you know, or think you know, which is the genius of peer-to-peer social media. Since our earliest evolution, humans have been unusually passionate about gossip. We were hooked on information as eagerly as sugar. Give us access to gossip the way modernity has given us access to sugar, and we have an uncontrollable impulse to binge. Just look around you at the people crouched over their phones as they walk the streets, or drive their cars, or walk their dogs, or play with their children. Observe yourself in line for coffee, or in a quick work break, or driving, or even just going to the bathroom. Visit an airport and see the sea of craned necks and dead eyes. We have gone from looking up and around to constantly looking down. The early days of the retreat at the meditation center passed by, the novelty slowly seeding to a realization that my meditation skills were now being tested more aggressively. Thoughts began to bubble up, memories clouded the present. The silent sessions began to be edged by a little anxiety. And then, unexpectedly, on the third day, as I was walking through the forest, I became overwhelmed. I'm still not sure what triggered it, but my best guess is that the shady, quiet woodlands, with brooks trickling their way down hillsides and birds flitting through the air, summoned memories of my childhood. I was a lonely boy who spent many hours outside in the copses and woodlands of my native Sussex in England. I had explored this landscape with friends, but also alone, playing imaginary scenarios in my head, creating little nooks where I could hang and sometimes read, learning every little pathway through the woods and marking each flower or weed or fungus that I stumbled on. But I was also escaping a home where my mother had collapsed with bipolar disorder after the birth of my younger brother, and had never really recovered. She was in and out of hospitals for much of my youth and adolescence, and her condition made it hard for her to hide her pain and suffering from her sensitive oldest son. I absorbed a lot of her agony, I came to realize later, hearing the screams of frustration and misery in constant, terrifying fights with my father, and never knowing how to stop it or to help. I remember watching her dissolve in tears in the car picking me up from elementary school at the thought of returning to a home she clearly dreaded, or holding her as she poured her heart out to me through sobs and whispers about her dead-end life in a small town where she was utterly dependent on a spouse. She was taken away from me several times in my childhood, starting when I was 4, and even now I can recall the corridors and rooms of the institution she was treated in when we went to visit. I knew the scar tissue from this formative trauma was still in my soul. I had spent 2 decades in therapy, untangling and exploring it, but I had never felt it so vividly since the very years it had first engulfed and defined me. It was as if, having slowly and progressively removed every distraction from my life, I was suddenly faced with what I had been distracting myself from. Resting for a moment against the trunk of a tree, I stopped, and suddenly I found myself bent over, convulsed with the newly present pain, sobbing. And this time, even as I eventually made it back to the meditation hall, there was no relief. I couldn't call my husband or a friend and talk it over. I couldn't check my email or refresh my Instagram or text someone who might share the pain. I waited for the mood to lift, but it deepened. Hours went by in silence as my heart beat anxiously and my mind reeled. I decided I would get some distance by trying to describe what I was feeling. The two words extreme suffering won the naming contest in my head. And when I had my 15-minute counseling session with my assigned counselor a day later, the words just kept tumbling out. After my panicked, anguished confession, he looked at me, one eyebrow raised, with a beatific half-smile. "Oh, that's perfectly normal," he deadpanned warmly. "Don't worry. Be patient. It will resolve itself." And in time it did. Over the next day, the feelings began to ebb. My meditation improved. The sadness shifted into a kind of calm and rest. I felt other things from my childhood, the beauty of the forests, the joy of friends, the support of my sister, the love of my maternal grandmother. Yes, I prayed and prayed for relief. But this lifting did not feel like divine intervention, let alone a result of effort, but more like a natural process of revisiting and healing and recovering. It felt like an ancient, long-buried gift. This was excerpted from I Used to Be a Human Being by Andrew Sullivan. We're on the Health and Science page now. The lead article is called At Least 2 Trillion Galaxies. The vast scale of the universe just became even more unfathomable. Until now, astronomers believed there were up to 200 billion galaxies that could theoretically be detected from Earth. But a new study suggests that the actual figure could be 10 times that, at least 2 trillion, and possibly many more. Researchers at the University of Nottingham in England used all the available data on deep space to create a 3D map of the observable universe. When they then ran that information through their mathematical models, they concluded that for the universe to behave the way it does, it must contain more than 2 trillion galaxies. The findings don't suggest the universe is any bigger than previously thought or that it contains more stars. They simply imply that stars are dispersed among larger number of smaller galaxies. That would confirm the top-down theory of universe formation, the idea that many small galaxies grew over time, eventually merging into the ones we see today. The researchers believe the most powerful telescopes we have can pick up only about 10% of the 2 trillion galaxies. It boggles the mind that over 90% of the galaxies in the cosmos have yet to be studied, lead researcher Christopher Consolis tells Slate.com. Who knows what interesting properties we will find when we study these galaxies with the next generation of telescopes? The Great Pyramid's Secret. More than 4,500 years after it was built, the Great Pyramid of Giza is still throwing up surprises. Researchers on the Scan Pyramids project have for the past year been using various imaging techniques to study the interior of the last of the classical seven wonders of the world. Last week, they announced they had found evidence of a previously unknown cavity behind the structure's north face, and another possible void along its northeast corner. The team, which made its discovery using an advanced scanning technique that measures how cosmic particles travel through a structure, believes the empty spaces could indicate the presence of a hidden corridor or a secret chamber. But the head of a committee overseeing their research has disputed the findings. The core of the pyramid was built using long stones and small stones, Zahi Hawass, the former Egyptian minister of antiquities, tells SmithsonianMag.com. I think there are no secret rooms, and that these anomalies have to do with the way the pyramid was built. The Scan Pyramids team has been given additional time to find more evidence. More data is expected in the first half of next year. The health scare of the week, calcium supplement risks. People who take calcium supplements to strengthen their bones may be increasing their risk of heart disease. Researchers analyzed the heart health and calcium intake of more than 1,500 adults between ages 45 and 84. At the start of the study, none of the participants showed signs of coronary artery calcification, CAC, a risk factor for hardened arteries. Overall, those who routinely consumed the most calcium had a lower risk for heart disease, but the opposite was true for participants whose calcium intake mostly came from supplements. In fact, taking a daily calcium supplement was associated with a 22% greater risk for CAC, reports the Washington Post. Unlike supplements, calcium-rich foods were not linked to heart disease. We think the body metabolizes supplements and dietary calcium differently, says the study's leader, Aaron Mikos. If you are worried about your bones, then get your calcium through food. And on the Talking Points page, abortion, the impact of the next president. Finally, an unapologetic defense of abortion rights from a Democratic presidential candidate, said Adrienne LaFrance in TheAtlantic.com. Until Hillary Clinton became the party's first woman nominee, Democrats supported the divisive issue of abortion rights with carefully hedged language. But in last week's final presidential debate, Clinton said flatly, "I will defend Roe v. Wade, and I will defend women's rights to make their own health care decisions," period. Republican Donald Trump, meanwhile, attacked Clinton's support of late-term abortions with graphic, inaccurate language suggesting women callously have healthy babies ripped from their wombs days before birth. In fact, partial birth abortion has been illegal since 2003. To date, 43 states have restrictions on late-term terminations, and studies show that just 1.3% of all abortions take place after 21 weeks. Most of them are wanted pregnancies in which the fetus has a major birth defect or the mother's health is at risk. Actually, Trump used simple, forceful language to expose Clinton's support of infanticide, said Daniel Payne in TheFederalist.com. She has opposed all abortion restrictions, and if she had her way, it would be entirely legal to rip the baby out of the womb just prior to birth. Besides, the health of the mother excuse has been broadened to absurdity to include physical, emotional, psychological, familial health. Dismissing late-term abortions as rare is specious, said Ramesh Ponuru in NationalReview.com. Even if that 1.3% figure is correct, it means there are more than 15,000 abortions after the 20th week, which exceeds the number of gun deaths in the U.S. last year, excluding suicides. In that context, does it still seem like an insignificant number? Clinton notwithstanding, things are looking good for the anti-abortion movement, said Charles Camosi in the Washington Post. Some 20 million Democrats identify as pro-life, many of them people of color, and a 2015 poll found that 52% of millennials identified as pro-life. Anti-abortion groups are springing up on college campuses, but a Trump presidency could seriously halt this momentum. He's loathed by the minorities and young people now joining the pro-life cause. If a misogynist with a history of denigrating and assaulting women becomes the angry, intolerant face of the anti-abortion movement, it will only play into deeply held stereotypes about oppressive males denying women their rights. And some shorter notes. The last time the Chicago Cubs were in the World Series, back in 1945, the price of gas was 15 cents a gallon. World Series ticket prices for the lower grandstand were $6 instead of today's $5,000. And a Slinky was the top Christmas gift of the year, while the year's most popular choice is a virtual reality headset. That's this year's choice. In the period of a year ending in July, more than 800 journalists were barraged with 19,253 anti-Semitic attacks on Twitter, according to a report by the Anti-Defamation League. The most frequent words in the Twitter biographies of the attackers were Trump, nationalist, American, conservative, and white. Superheroes have topped princesses as the country's top-selling children's Halloween costume for the first time in 11 years, at least partly because many girls are choosing to be Wonder Woman, Supergirl, Captain America, The Flash, and other powerful characters. About half of American adults, 117 million people, are already in a law enforcement face recognition network, according to a new study by researchers at Georgetown University. The compendium of photos of people's faces, which can be gathered from motor vehicle databases and other government records, can be used by police to secretly identify and get background information on people who are out in public. Since June, about 80% of the roughly 30,000 TV commercials aired on behalf of presidential candidates have been paid for by Hillary Clinton's campaign and various super PACs supporting her. Only 18% were on behalf of Donald Trump. And we'll finish the hour with a quote. This comes from mystery writer John D. McDonald, who says, "If any two people could ever really get inside each other's head, it would scare the pee out of them." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.